The following is the ninth part of a 15-part special teaching by Dr. Kenneth Boa on paradigm spirituality.
We've been talking about two rival value systems. The system that would look from top down, the other one from bottom up. The top-down system tells us that there is an eternal value system that needs to be pursued, and it takes great risk to pursue it because the eternal is not seen and not now. Remember that faith embraces that which is not seen and not yet. And the Hebrews 11 imagery that we've looked at before tells us that it takes tremendous risk to commit ourselves ultimately to the things that are not yet visible. The value system that comes from below supposes that this is all there is, and ultimately then says that this earth is your main source of felicity, of joy, of accomplishment, and therefore you need to find your pleasure in the present tense. Now, I want to draw some contrasts between those two systems, and to do that, let's take a quick look at James chapter 3 and verses 13 to 17. James, as you know, is the wisdom literature of the New Testament, and it is largely influenced both by Proverbs as well as the Sermon on the Mount. If you read James with that in mind, you'll see that Proverbs and the Sermon on the Mount are infused in his thinking. And James, a book that you cannot read without being hit between the eyes again and again. Would you agree with that? I mean, that I can't read that book without being nailed every time, so I don't read it anymore. That's the solution. If it bothers me, don't. James, having spoken about the tongue, which is very, very meddling, speaks about our speech, but then he goes from there and speaks about wisdom from above and contrasts that from the wisdom from below. And so he says in verse 13, James 3, "Who among you is wise and understanding?" Again, there's that theme of wisdom that he wants us to pursue. We've just been heard in James about the wisdom of controlling our speech, which is, by the way, a major category in the Proverbs, in the wisdom literature of the Old Testament. So you can actually trace and connect all these things down. May I say that the major point of this book is to see things from heaven's perspective, to get wisdom on your suffering, on your pain, your circumstances, so that you can actually, as he says in chapter 1, "And if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God." The wisdom he's talking about is to contextualize your various trials, and says to consider it joy because of the outcome, the long-term effect, not the short-term. In the short-term, we don't like trials and troubles, but in the long-term, he says, if you can contextualize it, wisdom tells us to get an eternal perspective. So he says, "Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom." Interesting expression, the gentleness of wisdom, which could be a term for humility, for restraint. "But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth." So by this he's contrasting then the wisdom that comes from below. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, demonic. "For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder and every evil thing." Before we go into that true wisdom that he concludes with, notice again, he's saying that this thing is earthly. It is natural. It is demonic. Why does he call it demonic? Because ultimately, Satan is the ruler of this world. He is the ruler of the prince of the power of the air. And the systems of this world then are in fact inspired in that spiritual warfare to be opposed to God. This world would tell you that this is all there is, and so anything that would encourage us to embrace something beyond this is really going to be a threat. And that's why James says, if you want to be a friend of the world, you make yourself an enemy of God, James 4. You can't play by both sets of rules. And so James is saying you need to discern your ultimate allegiance. And he's not going to be saying about that it's wrong for us to engage in business and make a profit, as he says in chapter 4. But rather, he is saying, don't be presumptuous in your plans about your future. Because it would be well for us to understand that bitter jealousy, selfish ambition, arrogance, these kinds of things then produce disorder in every evil thing. And all of these, of course, proceed from where? They all proceed from the heart, don't they? They're not external. These are internal things, but that they shape external behavior. So that James makes it very, very clear. Before I go back to chapter 3, go with me to chapter 1. I want you to notice again how important this is. In 1:13, let no one say when he is tempted, I'm being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin. When sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Do you notice the process here? This is the gestation of sin. First of all, it is conceived in your mind. That's the conception. And then it is something that grows and finally gives birth. And when it gives birth to action. So the sin is the concretized mind that was pursuing the things that are opposed to God. In other words, lust, evil desire, whatever that might be, in your mind, eventually, when given freedom to grow, will ultimately birth sin, so that what was in the mind now becomes real in the actions. And when sin is accomplished, that is to say, when it lives its life, what does it do? It brings forth death. So this is the birth of death, in effect. And then by contrast, he speaks about how every good thing and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. And he goes on to say, verse 21, therefore, putting aside all filthiness and all that remains of wickedness, in humility receive the word implanted, which is able to save your souls. Notice the contrast. If instead you receive the word implanted, it'll lead life to life. If you instead allow your own mindset, your own will that's opposed to God, your own desires, your own evil desires to be conceived and grow, it leads to death. Death is separation, and it's a separation from us and God. It's a separation from us and our neighbor, and between ourselves and ourselves. So by contrast then, going back to this, I want to make a strong claim here that we've talked about before. Your mind is the key. Almost every sermon I hear tells you this is what you ought to do. It says do. How often do you hear about how you think, about your will, about what you allow in your mind's eye, about your thought life? And I'm saying there your thought life is critical, because if you get the thought life correct, it will affect the actions. But if you try to change your actions, that won't necessarily affect your thoughts. Does that make sense? Yeah. One's outside in, the other's inside out. So it's critical, and I rarely hear this concept, and yet it's so essential. What do? We tolerate, I fear, a great deal of thoughts that are not worthy of the person we were called to be. Far, far below what we were called to be. And we actually, after a while, if we're not careful, rationalize it. And so, as Dallas Willard calls it, the Gospels of Sin Management, what we do is we manage our personal sin profile such that it will not cause an embarrassment to others. You see, keep it on a low profile. So who's to know what you're thinking? I'm going to tell you, your thought life will eventually be birthed in action, in one way or another. Because that what you think about, that what you meditate upon, will eventually change and shape your character.
Amen. A few months or a year ago, I think I heard you make a comment, though, about the fact that we can create habits by practicing.
That's correct.
Things. And then we internalize our emotions or our actions, and then we start going that
Yes,
way.
That's so a good point. They go together. It's my view it's a both and here. Attitudes can be manifested in actions, but actions can also change attitudes. So it's a reciprocal. Belief affects behavior, but behavior affects belief. So there's a reciprocal relationship between belief and behavior, between attitude and action. But what I'm suggesting here, though, is that so it's possible to think your way into a new self way of doing, and it's possible to do your way into a new way of thinking. And so I'm not minimizing those two sides of the coin, but I am saying that the part that's not emphasized is the thought life. Typically speaking, the thought life is underplayed. Sure, there are choices that we must make. That's why the Gospels are full of exhortations. But it's got to be based upon right choice. Didn't we talk about the fact that our wills are flabby and weak? You know, remember this idea. We've allowed in our culture, in Christianity, to allow our wills to become flabby through disuse. We just are given to whatever the mind wants to go on to without really making a choice. You know this, don't you, that you can either speak to yourself or listen to yourself. You can either speak to yourself or listen to yourself. Listen to yourself and you hear yourself whining and complaining and full of hatred and bitterness and all. Your mind, your flesh will naturally go off into all the right wrong things. That's listening to yourself, and you will meditate on something. Your mind is always meditating, always turning something over. Now, the other option is to choose what you think about, and that is to speak to yourself rather than to listen to yourself. So if we go on, and then I'm going to go back to this James, because these connect so well together. Recall the wonderful exhortation in Paul's epistle to the Philippians, chapter 4. And there he tells us, "Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there is any excellence, and if anything worthy of praise," what does he say to do? Yes, make your mind dwell on those things. Then he speaks about habit, the actual practice. The things you've learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things and the God of peace will be with you. See how the two go nicely together. In verse 7 of Philippians 4, 8, that has to do with your thought life, your attitudes, your beliefs. But verse 9 has to do with your actions and your behavior. They go together. It's a both and. But notice he puts the thoughts before the actions. And that's a very, very important thing. Again, we typically downplay the thought life. Now, here's what I'm saying. Do you normally, left to yourself, listening to yourself, meditate on what's true, honorable, right, pure, lovely, good repute, excellence, things worthy of praise? Let's be honest about it. If we're not careful, we're going to meditate on all the opposites of those things. And that's why newspapers sell well. If you had a newspaper just about good things people do, it's just not going to fly. You know, just try it out and see how you do. People have made this attempt to, you know, heroes, little heroes and little good things that they've done. But sorry to say, it doesn't fly because people finally are titillated by this kind of stuff. Just the opposite. And there's a certain pleasure, for example, in fondled resentments and in injuries and in an ambitious competition to the degree to which we actually envy another's success. Jealousy is when you want what they have. Envy is when you want them not to have it. You see? So there's an awful lot of subtle goings on. And here's what I'm saying. I'm just saying we're a little sloppy here. We tolerate more than we should. That's what I'm suggesting here. So as we go on to moving away from these attitudes of jealousy and selfish ambition, here's the wisdom that comes from above. By the way, there is a wisdom from below. But the wisdom from below is crafty, shrewd, cagey. You see that? It is a wisdom, but it's not the kind of wisdom from above. But don't deny that it's a wisdom. The serpent was more cunning than all the beasts of the field. Cunning, craftiness, caginess. You know what I'm talking about. That's earthly wisdom. And some people become so good at it that they're capable of manipulating people to get their ends in any way they want. But here's the wisdom by contrast from above. It's first pure. That is to say, it doesn't have any hidden agendas. It doesn't play by two sets of rules. Purity of heart, remember, is to will one thing. Then it's peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. No hypocrisy. What you see is what you get. Your yes is your yes, and your no is your no. There is no nonsense going on here. It doesn't waver. It commits to a truth and then clings to it. You swear even to your hurt. You make a deal, and then you discover that you're not going to actually make money off the thing. You priced it too low. You swear to your hurt. You don't back out. You see what my point here? I know a friend who was involved in the Gatlinburg Aquarium, and one of his number one guy under him made a terrible mistake and made a bid that turned out not to be realistic. They committed themselves, and my friend who owns the company, they did the project and basically lost their shirts on it. He had the option of backing out. There were ways in which he could have reneged on the arrangement, but he felt that you swear to your hurt. or to your gain. You see the point there? There's a fundamental commitment. That wisdom, of course, would tell you to price it right. So I'm not downplaying that. Unfortunately, this guy took some authority that he shouldn't have taken. But my point is, there comes a point where you have to make that choice. So he's saying here that wisdom tells us then to be a person with that has mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. The seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. So the contrast is something, for example, between that which produces disorder and jealousy and every evil thing, and that which produces harmony and peace and shalom. A book that's by Cornelius Plantin gave you, but you had to read this. It's called Not the Way It's Supposed to Be, and it's a breviary on sin. And it's a discussion of the nature of sin itself. And I love the way he defines sin. He defines sin as a culpable disturbance of shalom. Isn't that a great way? A culpable disturbance of shalom. What that means is that shalom means more than just peace. It means harmony. It means unity. It means a convergence so that people are in shalom with one another and with God. And a culpable disturbance of that, one that a person chooses to make then, is that which produces sin, which isn't a bad description of what we've just seen in James chapter 3 about the evil that comes from below and the shalom that comes from above. Let's move on to then some comparisons between the temporal and the eternal. And it's my conviction that this is a major theme in the Gospels as well. My own belief, by the way, is that Jesus spoke more about the temporal versus the eternal than any other topic. Usually we hear that he spoke more about money than any other topic. No, actually, the money was an illustration of the temporal versus the eternal. That's what it was. It wasn't the money itself. It illustrated, are you going to pursue that which is going to last, or are you going to pursue that which will let you down in the end, you see? And by the way, I want to stress something again. Jesus is not opposed to profit. He knows that we were wired this way. We should pursue profit. We should pursue gain. He's just saying, though, make sure, though, that what you pursue won't let you down, either in this life or in the next. You see what he's saying? Make sure you go for that which really is profitable and will sustain you in the end. And it doesn't mean that there's no possibility of earthly profit. No, clearly that's not the case. But the scriptures teach us, though, that in your making of wealth, as you amass that, make sure you do it through kingdom values and use it as such, as a steward who will be accountable before the king. So understand that your wealth is not your own. He gives you the power to make wealth. He raises you up, he lifts you down. Even with billable hours, there's 1,000 ways in which he can bring you down. It doesn't matter how hard you work, there's 1,000 ways in which he can affect your lifestyle. You know this. You cannot control your outcome. It all depends really on the good providence of God, but also that doesn't minimize good stewardship of our time and resources. You see the balance. On the one hand, we see God sovereign, but on the other hand, we're called to be diligent, aren't we? And to be hardworking, but to do it for the right audience, to play to an audience of one, and to be serving the king, and to do it not by way of eye service as a man-pleaser, but to do it as servants of Christ from the heart. And thus, the result will be that your work will be actually of a higher quality and excellence than it would be if you tried to do it just to impress people. Because God sees what people do not see. So if you're playing to him, that makes the difference. Do you remember some years ago, I don't know, maybe it wasn't so many years ago, I forget, I don't know what I say anywhere. I told you about my first time in England, about the Westminster Abbey. How long ago did, how many of you heard me talk about that? Well, it's worth hearing again. You heard it before? You heard it before, you're going to hear it again. Because I think this is such a wonderful illustration of this concept. And it illustrates two rival value systems, the temporal versus the eternal. This is as good a way of perceiving what one person living as a craftsman for the temporal, another as a craftsman for the eternal. When I went to Westminster Abbey for the very first time, I think it was 1984, they did something that had never been done. They moved, they removed the statues that were in the chancel to clean them after 700 years. It's a little late for spring cleaning. But the fact is they moved them to clean them up. And guess what their amazement was when they saw the backsides and saw that the backsides were as carved as well as on the front. even though they knew once put in place, no human eye would see it. What does that tell you? That was not work. They weren't just going to work to make a buck. They were doing it to be pleasing and honoring to Christ. Now, the laborer is worthy of his hire, and clearly that's a factor. And through this work, they supported their families and so forth. But at the end of the day, they were not doing it to impress people. They were doing it as an act of worship. That's why I stress, your work is an arena of worship. Understand, your work is as much worship as what you do on Sunday morning, if you do it to be honoring to the King. I don't know if many men don't think of work as worship, but it is. If you're doing it, it's the audience to whom you play is what makes the difference. So understanding these two rival value systems then, let's take a look at some contrasts. One is between the pursuit of pleasure on the temporal versus the pursuit of knowing God on the eternal. Now, in this warfare, then, the world promotes pleasure as an end in itself. And it implies, then, people who are willing to forego earthly pleasures to pursue God's ways, they're missing out on the good life. That's really what it says. You're missing out on the good life if you have any intention of foregoing any of this world's pleasure to pursue the ways of God. And the Word, though, by contrast, says something quite different. The Word tells us that, in fact, God is the greatest pleasure of all, that He is the source and the wellspring of the good life, the true good life. By comparison, everything else is a shadow. Wasn't there a magazine called The Good Life that came out for a while? I seem to recall something like by that name. It was defined as defined the good life, by the way, as eating well but staying slim. Defined the good life as going to fabulous places. Defined the good life as hot tubs and hot babes. Basically, it was a mindset that was so totally inimical to the world, to the value system of Scripture, and that's the quote good life, wining and dining and living it up. Does that good life really produce an outcome that is good? Ask anyone who's had that opportunity and you'll discover its emptiness in the end. It doesn't satisfy the heart. We pursue it. It's pleasurable after a way, but you know, there's a kind of a loss of pleasure. Diminishing returns begin to take place, and what was pleasurable at first, now you need to up the ante, and it just seems that it reduces and reduces and reduces until it's not satisfying in the end. It's ashes and dust. Whereas the pleasure of God, the true good life, the good life is to pursue the supreme good. The summum bonum is the word for the supreme good, and God Himself is the supreme good, and to pursue Him is the good life. And by the way, where do you suppose pleasure comes from anyway? Where does pleasure come from? Did Satan invent pleasure? What does Lewis say in the Screwtape Letters? He says our enemy, these are demons speaking, our enemy, our father below, which is Satan, has never been able to create a pleasure. Only the enemy's been able to do that. No, that's a very important insight. Satan has never been able to invent a pleasure. God creates the pleasures. Satan can only distort them and invite you to use God's good pleasures for in the wrong way, for the wrong reason, in the wrong amount. And so he takes those good things and causes us to distort them. But where does pleasure come from? It comes not from the enemy. It comes not from the world. The ultimate wellspring of pleasure is God Himself. Doesn't He say that there are pleasures at My right hand forever and ever? Remember that image here? So I believe that the pleasure of His company, 5 minutes in the pleasure of His company, would be worth more than 80 years in the pleasure of the so-called good life on this earth. No comparison. So what I'm suggesting then is that you have two ways of looking at it. Pursuing pleasure as an end in itself, which ironically never leads to pleasure in the long run. Or pursuing God as the wellspring of pleasure, but you're not pursuing God to get pleasure. You're pursuing Him as an end in itself, but then in doing so, you discover that true joy and pleasure is thrown in. That's the first contrast between pleasure and knowing God. The second contrast I have is between the recognition of people and the approval of God. The world invites us to pursue recognition and people's accolades. Many people are driven to be famous. You see this whole idea? reality TV shows are really scary, aren't they? For 15 minutes of fame, people will degrade themselves in any number of bizarre ways. I mean, it's totally degradation, you know? And on certain television programs, people will bear their soul to 10 million people that they wouldn't tell anyone else, you see? And so one person said, "Why didn't you tell me?" "Well, I didn't want anyone to know." Now he's going to tell 10 million people. People are totally irrational. Plus, I don't think you have to pay them much to do this, just to have their 15 minutes of fame. What is fame in the end? What do people who are very famous tell you about fame? Uniformly, it's not all it was cracked up to be.
Short-lived.
It's very short. Not only, but even if it's long-lived, even if you have a fame that continues on and spans quite a lifetime, and
it's
some do.
They're kind of
invasive and burdensome. In fact, they want to go incognito. They get weary of their fawning admirers.
We're not designed for worship and cannot handle it.
Yeah, I think it's a good way. You hear what he said? We're not designed for worship and we can't handle it. You know, the human being is the only animal, you pat him on his back and his head swells. We can't handle it and we weren't meant for it. It's dishonorable to worship men. But it is honorable and right to worship God. He himself is worthy of all worship because he's the wellspring of all that's good and beautiful and true. By the way, I think he enjoys it when you thank him for things that are often not that you often don't thank him for. For example, when's the last time you thanked God when you saw a beautiful sunset? You see? Or an extraordinary creature like a butterfly. Yesterday I was with my friend and was in the front of our house, and Karen has a lot of beautiful plants that are specifically strong in attracting butterflies. And I saw a couple types I hadn't seen in a long time. And just to watch their movement and just the grace, to me that's worship if you really see it. I think I've given you this assignment, but I'm going to give you this assignment again if I haven't. It's go and get. It's not that expensive. It's called The Blue Planet, and it's a BBC production. It's on four DVDs. The whole thing is maybe $40 or something. It's not much. And each DVD has 2 one-hour segments. And in this, it talks about the oceans and the tides and so forth, and land and life on the sea coasts, under the ocean. I'm going to tell you something. This is stuff no one in previous generations ever could have seen or known. And it's so beautifully done that Karen and I have seen 3 of them so far out of the 8. And I'm telling you, every time we're through, it's total worship. You're just totally boggled. Not only because of the glory of these creatures that he makes, but then how perfectly harmonized they are to one another and to their environment. It staggers the imagination. Things that one could not have even imagined. You do well, by the way, and I think God takes pleasure when you thank him for a beautiful tree. Or a sunset, or a bird, or a flower, or even the noise of creatures, insects, and the sound of birds. These are things that I think please God, because generally we take them in stride. And so I think we do well to understand that concept, that he alone is worthy of worship. So the world will tell us that we must pursue recognition and approval of people, but the word exhorts us to desire the approval of God. Paul said it well in Galatians 1:10. "For am I now seeking the favor of men or of God? Or am I striving to please men?" And no, here's what I want you to hear. If I were still striving to please men, I would not be a bondservant of Christ. You can't have it both ways. You cannot strive to be pleasing to men and be a servant to Christ. A choice will be made, and you cannot straddle that fence. At the end, a choice will be made. Shall I do one more, Henry? Or, okay, one more of these, a third contrast. This third contrast is between the quest for popularity and the pursuit of servanthood. The world tells us to pursue popularity, but yet it's an empty thing, as we've just observed. Using the arena of history, Paul Johnson illustrates the futility of the quest for popular relevance. Paul Johnson's a wonderful British historian and has written some extraordinary trenchant analyses of our own culture and times. He put it this way, "The study of history moves on remorselessly like time itself. Today's sensation becomes tomorrow's irrelevance. Just think about that. Isn't that a great line right there? Let's think about it. The fact is, the most famous person, let's say in any sport, in any arena, will later, in some future generation, if Christ doesn't tarry, be a good question for Trivial Pursuit. Some future issue of Trivial Pursuit. Gosh, you know, who's Chris Everett? You know, and I promise you, a little bit longer, and it'll be Trivial Pursuit. That which was the highest accolade, that received the highest accolades in her arena of endeavor, becomes less and less known. So his point is, as he says, today's sensation becomes tomorrow's irrelevance. The bestseller of one decade becomes the embarrassment of another. The revolutionary theory which convulses the academic world gets cut down in the next age to an ironic footnote. I think that's a very insightful point. But in contrast, the Word of God tells us to emulate the servanthood of Christ. You see, there's the difference. It's been well said that everyone ought to fear to die until we have done something that will always live. You ought to fear to die until you've done something that will always live. And all of us have been called to do something that will always live. And since people go into eternity then, other centered acts of kindness and sacrificial service that are born out of love for Christ endure forever. So true servanthood then of people who are eternal beings, servanthood in the name of the living God actually ripples on forever. You're not going to be some future edition of Trivial Pursuit or some ironic footnote. So just to summarize then, and we'll pick this up next time, the contrast between pleasure and knowing God, between the recognition of people versus the approval of God, and between popularity versus servanthood couldn't be greater. The Scripture invites us to pursue those things, knowing God, approving God, approval of God, and servanthood, even though they may appear at the end to be less satisfying than pleasure, people's recognition, and popularity at the end. The satisfaction only comes with the pursuit of the eternal.
To order additional copies of this CD or other selections from Ken Boa's teachings, call 800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 800-372-9632, or contact us through the Reflections Ministries website at www.reflectionsministries.org.